Senator Murphy, welcome to the Tax Committee. Members, we have Senate File 222 in front of us. Senator Murphy.
Mr. Chairman, thanks for the opportunity to present this bill with my friend Rick Mosqua here, who is actually, I got to get your name exactly right. Oh, yeah.
And members, maybe while they're getting organized, Senator Marty, Senator Skoy, Senator Scheid, you'll see in your packet there is a office memorandum from Brad Moore, then Commissioner of PCA, that indicates that, I think, well, to read exactly what he said in part, he said, "We believe the exemption language in statute inadvertently overlooked the two waste-to-energy projects owned and operated by cities." And then you see a department response from the Commissioner of Revenue, where in part he says, "I have decided to suspend action on tax implications to any waste-to-energy facility until after the 2009 legislative session." So it does appear like there may have been a little drafting oversight on the part of us when we made this exemption earlier. But Senator Murphy?
Mr. Chairman, Rick is actually the new director of Public Works in the city of Red Wing. He was promoted here this past Monday at the council meeting, and Marshall Hollick has been our assistant city administrator for, I don't know, 8 years now? Is that about right?
Yes.
Okay. And but, Mr. Chairman and committee members, the reason the Senate File 222 is here, just as the chair indicated, was that this was an oversight on our part to include you know, these cities, these municipals that have you know, solid waste operations. And I think all the documentation, either from Mr. Moore or Ward Innes, or you know, from our new PCA commissioner, Mr. Ager, all indicate that as being true, and they want this rectified as well. There is a fiscal note that is attached to this, and speaking with the chair previous discussions, I forget the word that the chairman used. He uses big words, but it's a nominal sum, put it that way. It's not much. So I'll let Mr. Mosqua kind of outline where we're at the city of Red Wing with solid waste issues.
But it's just the solid waste.
Thank you. Good morning, Honorable Chair and members of the committee. I'm Rick Mosqua, the Public Works Director in Red Wing. I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 222. Red Wing respectfully requests your support for an exemption of the solid waste management tax for service charges supporting a waste-to-energy facility owned and operated by the City of Red Wing. Specifically, I'm seeking your support of Senate File 222 to exempt cities that own and operate waste-to-energy facilities from this tax. The City of Red Wing currently owns and operates this facility within the city limits. This facility opened in 1982. It's the first municipally owned facility in the state. It replaced a landfill, and it provides a responsible disposable alternative for waste generated in our area. This facility is highly regulated by the MPCA and the EPA, providing a form of renewable energy through the generation of steam and hot water for large industrial concerns, namely the SB Foot Tanning Company, which does provide the leather for Red Wing Shoe Company, which are also located right in the city of Red Wing, along with all of our region's trash disposal, upwards of 21,000 tons of waste brought to this facility on a yearly basis. The facility is one of two facilities owned and operated by a Minnesota city. The remainder of incinerators throughout the state are county-owned and operated or privately held. Pursuant to ordinance, the City of Red Wing imposed a city environmental service charge. This charge is collected from all residents and business owners in the cities to cover a portion of the city's comprehensive solid waste services, including processing of recycling, processing of yard waste, composting, and other services, white goods, e-waste, and the like. Under Minnesota statutes, local counties that promote waste energy facilities are exempt from paying a solid waste management tax on the rates and charges for solid waste management services provided by the county. However, no such similar exemption applies to cities, and that's why we're here today. When we went through this statute, the Department of Revenue recognized that, came down and asked us to correct that, and then we're here to try to correct that today. And based on what the Senator has spoken about before, the Department of Revenue, along with PCA, has talked about this internally, and the PCA is recommending that. We want to make sure that we are treated the same way as other counties are treated, even though we're a city. So last July, the commissioner of the PCA, Brad Moore, submitted an office memo to the Department of Revenue Commissioner Ward Innes describing an inequitable application of the solid waste management tax exemption. In this memo, Commissioner Moore expressed his department's position that the PCA will not object if the Department of Revenue delays a decision on the city's tax liability related to this issue until the 2009 legislative session is over. Further, Commissioner Moore stated his belief that the exemption language in the statute inadvertently overlooked the waste energy projects owned and operated by cities. A copy of this memorandum has been distributed to the committee chair and members. It's also worth knowing that the newly appointed PCA Commissioner Paul Egger has affirmed his agency's belief that the exemption language in the statute inadvertently overlooks cities that own and operate waste energy projects. And his agency continues to support allowing this legislation to resolve this issue. In a memorandum responded dated August 4, 2008, Department of Revenue Commissioner Innes suspended action on tax implications of any waste-to-energy facility operated by a city until after the 2009 legislative session. Commissioner Innes stated that the pursuit of the tax on the CESC to be an unnecessary burden on the city of Red Wing. And why we did this is so that we could get our tip fee lower so we could attract the waste to this facility. Landfills typically charge a lower fee. They're less expensive to run, and we needed to track waste to this facility to keep this facility operating to provide those jobs at the SB Foot Tannery and the shoe company to create the leather for the product. A copy of Commissioner Innes' memorandum has been provided. The City of Red Wing firmly believes that providing cities that own and operate waste energy facilities with the same exemption from the solid waste management tax that counties receive is a matter of equity. The City of Red Wing has exemplified foresight and environmental awareness when it began the operation of the waste energy facility, assuming a responsibility normally left to counties. And as a result, the city's actions have helped promote sustainable energy, created jobs, and improved our community. It's only fair for the state to treat cities who operate waste energy facilities in the same manner as it treats counties. As the MPCA noted in its correspondence, it is likely that a mere drafting oversight occurred in current statute, which overlooked exempting waste to energy products owned and operated by cities from the solid waste management tax in the manner counties are. Senate File 222 addresses this inequity and creates a level playing field for cities that operate waste-to-energy facilities. In conclusion, the City of Red Wing respectfully requests your support of Senate File 222, and I thank the committee chair and members for the opportunity to testify before you today in support of this file. We'd be happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Questions? Senator Limmer?
Not yet. Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer, I'm down now.
I've only had four cups of coffee, Mr. Chairman. It's early.
Mr. Chairman,
I'd love to move the bill, but we don't have a quorum, so we're going to have to lay it over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Okay, that's fine. Mr. Chairman, we're going to have a tax bill, though, right?
Senator Murphy, I'd be surprised if we can resolve this budget session without a tax bill.
Okay, that's what I wanted to hear.
It's this bill that carries the budget reserve, Senator Murphy, and currently the state has no budget reserve, so I'd be surprised if we can go forward to the next biennium with no budget reserve.
Even Senator Limmer agrees to that, Mr. Chairman.
I was nodding, Mr. Chairman. I don't know if I was nodding off or not, but...
Well, Mr. Chairman, this bill is, it's pretty simple. It's just, it's fairness. And, the city has been doing what we had asked, you know, a lot of counties to do across the state. And, you know, they've been good stewards with the product that comes down to the incinerator. And, you know, it's just a fairness issue. We asked them to do this, and then they got caught up in this kind of catch-22 tanglement. And
Senator Murphy, I don't want to speak for the other members of the committee, but I think the committee likes this bill.
Good. Mr. Chairman, it could go on its own. I mean, if
city officials from Red Wing need to know that if we had a list, an ABC ranking, this probably would be on a, I don't think it needs any revisions, so it probably would be a very good piece of legislation, Senator Murphy.
So this would be on the A list?
I think this would probably make the A list if we had such a list.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Chair lays over Senate File 222 for inclusion in the omnibus bill. Senator Olstein? Senator Olstein, you see how easy it is?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm pleased to be in front of you today with a group from Chisago County. We're talking about the City of Taylor's Falls for a border city development zone. And I've got with me today the mayor of Taylor's Falls, Mayor Buchheit, and Chris Eng, who's the Chisago County HRA EDA director, and Wade Vitalis, who is a business owner in Taylor's Falls that has some pretty compelling testimony about competing with a state that is a stone's throw away and across a bridge. And also there should be a handout that has a map showing the location of Taylor's Falls to St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin. And this very interesting handout, which is called the Wisconsin Calculator, there's been a couple times in the past where I've read a letter from Governor Doyle about comparing Wisconsin and Minnesota. And I do want to point one thing out to you guys before we get into this, is that in the letter from Governor Doyle, it said that Wisconsin would save 40% or more on their workman's comp. In this Wisconsin calculator, it's down to 20%. So we must be moving ahead on our work comp. So we've closed that gap a little bit, it looks like. But there are still some very significant problems for Taylor Falls with their being so close to St. Croix Falls. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to Mayor Buchheit.
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair, Senators, I'm sure that you recognize us. I was here last year, and I believe the year before that. It was actually to testify for a emergency services that we provide for the Interstate State Park. And I do appreciate all of your hard work on that. We were successful in actually obtaining the $30,000. But unfortunately, the way it was plugged into the LGA formula, it ended up in a net zero gain. But I'm actually here today to request that we be allowed to participate in an existing program. It's the Minnesota Cities, the Border Cities Development Zone. And for those of you who aren't familiar with Taylor's Falls, we're on the eastern side of Minnesota. Our city has a population of 1,054. And we're known as the eighth poorest city in the state of Minnesota with a population of greater than 500. Now, my budget for 2009 is $693,000. And what I'm looking at for 2009 is a $45,000 cut in LGA. And I'll deal with it. I know that times are hard. I'll make the proper adjustments. But what I'm attempting to do is raise revenues. And I'm not looking at just making cuts. Now, we actually have before us a challenge, but we actually have an opportunity, and I'm excited about the opportunity. We had in 2001 a building known as the Livery Mall, built in 1886, was actually a livery mall with horses. That building caught fire on January 12th, my wife's birthday, 2001, burned to the ground. And unfortunately, today that property has yet to be developed. That property pays about $2,200 in property taxes, so there is some revenue. However, if you put a building in that location, it's been estimated to be about $1 million to put a building there. That would generate about $35,000 in property taxes. So you and I are losing revenue because that property has not been developed. Now, the other opportunity we have, which is very exciting for us, is MnDOT has a building located on our Main Street. Our Main Street is four city blocks long. MnDOT takes up one entire block. It consists of a truck station and a salt storage area. And the good news is that building needs a lot of work. And so MnDOT has said, why would we want to invest a lot of money in that location if Taylor's Falls is willing to build us a building next to our existing public works building, put up a salt storage area, and we'll actually leave that property. So what I've done is I've partnered with the Chisago County HRA EDA to provide us with financing so we can actually build a new facility. It's not fancy. It's going to have one truck stall, one loader, gets the MnDOT property off the main street of Taylor's Falls. So the opportunity we have is we can build a building in that location. I can bring in more revenue in that location, possibly some retail businesses. The second floor could be assisted living, senior living, something that helps make our downtown area look like a downtown instead of a truck station area. Now, I do have a challenge that I mentioned, and that challenge is St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin. And I've testified down here earlier and been told, well, St. Croix Falls is 3 miles away. And if you look in the map in your folder, you'll find out we're not 3 miles away. My wife and I are avid walkers. We walk across the bridge. It's about 1,000 feet to go from Taylor's Falls to St. Croix Falls. And I'm competing with them on that tax basis. That challenge that I have is, why would somebody build a building in the old Livery Mall location, in the MnDOT property location, if I can build the exact same building in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin, and pay half the property taxes? So that's my challenge, is overcoming that. I've been asked by some of the local business owners, now, how is the stimulus package going to help our businesses in town? And we're hearing about this blanket fix, which is the reduction of the corporate tax. That's going to help us, right? And the sad news is that's going to have absolutely no effect on the small businesses, the commercial properties in Taylor's Falls. What's killing us is property taxes. And I've been working hard to bring down the tax rate. When I came into office 4 terms ago, our tax rate was 101. The tax rate today is 81. So we do have a good idea of what we need to do and how to get there by bringing down the tax rate by 20%. The concern that I have is my ability to attract new commercial property buildings when I have St. Croix Falls so close. And the most recent problem that I have is that retaining of my existing businesses because they're being attracted to St. Croix Falls. You know, I'm actually losing that small town feeling because I can't compete with St. Croix Falls. I have lost the local grocery store. The people retired, and that's fine. They can retire, but the problem is we couldn't get a young couple to come in and take it over because we can't afford the property taxes. And besides that, we're competing with Marketplace Foods in St. Croix Falls. We're competing with the new Super Walmart in St. Croix Falls for food. How can we afford to pay the property taxes plus put groceries in here and sell them at a competitive price? And the answer is we can't. The most recent loss that we've had was December of 2007. We lost our bank. It was the bank that's been there for many years. And where did it go? St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin. They started by having 2 branches and then said, well, you know, it makes more sense to have it just in St. Croix Falls. We'll close the Taylor's Falls branch. So what I'm looking for is I need a partner. I need the state of Minnesota to be my partner so that I can compete with Wisconsin. And in your bill, it talks about $30,000 the first year, and I'm looking at using that tax relief. It's revenues that we would not be collecting temporarily until I can get some properties built in the old Livery Mall location and the MnDOT property, help me generate some revenues here. It's not all just about making cuts. That $30,000, that represents a 15% reduction in our commercial property taxpayers' taxes. That second year where it's $35,000 and the third year at $35,000, it would be the same $30,000 for the commercial property taxpayers. However, we'd be looking at using $5,000 as some incentive to develop that burn down property location, the MnDOT property location. So that's the situation that I'm in. And again, Mr. Chair and Senators, I do appreciate your time. I know you're all very busy just like I am. And with that, I'd like to pass the microphone to Chris Ng. He is Director of the HRA EDA for Chisago County.
Mr. Chairman, members, good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to come and testify before you this morning. My name is Chris Ng. I'm the Executive Director of the Chisago County Housing and Redevelopment Authority and Economic Development Authority, and I've been in this position for 7 years now. been doing economic development for 16 years, some of it in Wisconsin, some of it in Minnesota. But I think the challenge that's before us this morning is getting worse. I think we're losing the border battle. And I want to thank you by start up by thanking you for all the hard work you're doing in addressing the massive budget deficit that's in front of us and the challenges that the state is facing. But at the local level, we're facing some serious challenges as well, losing revenues, losing jobs. In fact, we've lost 7 businesses in the last 7 years to Wisconsin, and we can't afford to lose anymore. We can't continue to see the businesses move across the river to take advantage of tax benefits and losing revenues. I have with me, as Senator Alcine identified, we have got a letter from Governor Doyle, and these letters are being circulated to our businesses on a regular basis saying, come on over to move your business to Wisconsin. We'll save you 50% on your industrial and commercial property taxes. Now it's 20% on the corporate, on the workers' comp taxes and 20% on the corporate income taxes. We also have some comparisons that Senator Alcine shared with you that I just wanted you to be aware of. And so our challenge today is to try, our number one goal is to try to keep our existing businesses. And the number two goal, obviously, is to attract more businesses into Taylor's Falls to help increase our revenues at the local level and also at the state level. We just can't afford to lose any more businesses. And I'll keep my comments brief. I think it's going to be more important to hear from a local business owner, but I just want to share one more thing. St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin has 14 industrial businesses in their industrial park. Taylor's Falls has 1. And there's really no reason why we couldn't bring more businesses here, but as soon as we bring a company up to show them what we've got available, they look across the river and say, well, maybe we should check and see what's available on the other side of the river. And as you can see, again, by 14-1, we're losing that border battle. And so the question we have for you today is, it's a policy question. Will the state allow the businesses, the communities on the eastern side of the state to take advantage of a program that already exists? It's the Border Cities Development Zone, the same program that's available on the western side of the state. And with that, I'll turn it over to Wade Vitalis, our local business owner in Taylor's Falls.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Senator Limmer.
Just on the last witness, you made a reference to a letter from the governor of Wisconsin. Could we get a copy of that letter?
It's in the packet.
It is in ours? Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Limmer.
The point that the witness is bringing up, I thought the state of Wisconsin had higher property taxes in general than Minnesota did. Has there been some recent change to the Wisconsin policy that they're now selling themselves on a smaller tax hit?
Senator Limmer, maybe we'll ask the commissioner when we have him come up, but I understand is Wisconsin only has 1 class rate for all right. types of property. What I don't know, and if one of you knows, you can answer what that rate is. I suspect residential taxes are probably higher
much
for a
higher.
Home in Wisconsin.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Senators, we were asked that question at the House of Representatives meeting, and we actually ran some comparisons, do have that information available for you. The commercial property taxes in Wisconsin are 50% lower than in Minnesota. When you look at the property taxes on residential properties, the taxes are lower in Minnesota than they are in Wisconsin. However, when we did comparisons of St. Croix Falls to Minnesota, Taylor's Falls, what we found is because of the large amount of money that continues to flow into St. Croix Falls, the property taxes are coming down in leaps and bounds in St. Croix Falls. If you have a $200,000 home in Taylor's Falls, your property taxes are $3,100 a year. If you have that same home in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin, the property taxes are $3,700 a year. That gap is closing. There will be a time in the near future where Wisconsin will be able to boast that not only do we have lower commercial property taxes, we have lower residential taxes. We did the same comparison of a $200,000 home in Stillwater, and that home is $1,900 a year in property taxes. So I'm not only competing with St. Croix Falls, I'm competing with Stillwater. I'm 30 miles from Stillwater, a long ways away, not a huge problem, but my advantage in residential taxes is going away, and it's going to continue to as long as Wisconsin grows at the rate that it does.
How much of that disparity is reflected in school levies? Do we know?
I don't know the answer to that, to be honest.
I would argue that
Senator Rest?
And I'd be interested to know if Wisconsin has a property tax refund program like Minnesota does. So the person living in that $200,000 house with their $3,100 tax break or taxes, do they qualify for the PTR? Because we're talking about ultimate tax burden, and you really cannot dismiss the homeowner's refund program and talking about what the tax burden is. It's not free money. It's based on income relative to the value of the house and the taxes placed on it, or not the value of the house, but the taxes. So we need to be asking also just about net taxes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I have a sister-in-law who lives in Osceola and about a $300,000 home, and they pay about $6,000. So they don't have the state buying down her property taxes. She's very clear to me whenever I see her about that. So
there you go.
Is that the homeowner's refund?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, I think the point is it would be nice if you could live in Taylor's Falls and go to your job in St. Croix Falls, and that's their concern, is the commercial.
Yes. Yes.
You know, we got some relief. We brought that rate down. I don't know how many years ago it is now.
There's been a great deal of rate compression happening on CI. I think when I came to the legislature, we were over 5%. And now we're down at 2, I believe.
So, I think we made great progress here. I'm not suggesting we need to go further there, but we need to be sensitive to these border issues, obviously.
Senator Langstedt, how do property taxes in Moorhead compared to Fargo?
Mr. Chair, the housing is right now not much more than half as much in Moorhead. The property taxes, of course, we have the disparity reduction credit, so we're at 2.3, which they are across the river. If there was not for that, Moorhead, I think, would be in the area of 3.6% as compared to Fargo's 2.3 or something. It'd be, but it isn't as significant as it once was. I mean, I think it was 5.2% was our base, and now it's 2% plus that state tax, which I think brings it to about 2.4. So we've really, really been bringing it down, but a number of states do just have kind of a flat rate. And, you know, I guess I understand the philosophy of that, but our house taxes on homes are one of the lowest in the United States.
Senator Lamar.
Also, the other thing to consider in this discussion is perhaps the income tax of all these states that kind of are now competing for businesses and locations. I don't know North Dakota. Do they even have an income tax?
Yes.
Do they have a corporate income tax?
Yes.
All right. And I know Wisconsin does. But good to visit that issue from time to time.
And Mr. Chairman?
Senator Scheid.
Sure. I'm concerned about them saying they're first on the ACT scores. I thought we were. And I do notice that their wages must be 20% less if you have a savings of 20%. But, you know, so there's an overall quality of life kind of thing here, too. But I'm concerned about that ACT thing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Scheid, Minnesota and Wisconsin are always flipping on that. So we're right next to them on that. Okay. Depends what year it is.
But, Mr. Chairman, Minnesota had the perfect score on the SATs, 2400.
That's right.
Sam Peterson, Chaska.
Maybe one of you could tell me, who is Forward Wisconsin?
Mr. Chairman, if I could answer that one. Forward Wisconsin is comparable to Positively Minnesota. It's the state's marketing division, kind of operating independently, but part of the Wisconsin Department of Commerce.
So has our Department of Deed done anything similar to help you promote against Wisconsin? I mean, I would think that Deed could put some argument together that Minnesota's a good place to do business. Have they undergone such an effort?
Mr. Chairman, again, no. And the reality is, and I don't know how much you want to go into this today, but the state's marketing budget for Positively Minnesota is about $100,000 a year, and that's just not cutting it. There are states, Ohio, for example, I think others like New Mexico, that are spending millions of dollars a year in marketing efforts. I couldn't tell you exactly what Wisconsin's are, but $100,000 for Minnesota, for Positively Minnesota, is just not cutting it.
Senator Pogemiller, maybe that's a question we should ask former Representative McElroy next time he's in. We'll ask that question on behalf of the city of Taylor's Falls.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langston.
I think I've seen the tax foundation's figures, and North Dakota and Wisconsin are almost identical if you figure taxes per capita. But, of course, we're higher on some and we're lower on some. So I think if you melt it all down, it's somewhat the same. But being on the border myself, I understand the situation that they have to deal with.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
Well, after we kind of hashed this out and determined that Minnesota's tax rates are pretty much level with everything else, then why are the businesses not locating here, and why are they locating across rivers and borders then? There's something more to it that we have to know. The bottom line is we're not getting these businesses to locate in our cities and towns. That's the problem we gotta wrestle with.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
The bottom line is Minnesota is going to overtake Wisconsin in population this decade. That tells you something, too.
Are they losing population?
No.
Wisconsin? We're gaining?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller.
In higher ed, there's a massive brain drain from Wisconsin to Minnesota. So if someone wants to turn this state into Wisconsin, they may want to think about that twice.
But the businesses are still locating in other states.
Senator Limmer, I'm not sure businesses are doing much expanding or locating, relocating.
Maybe not.
In this jobs climate at all.
Mr. Chairman, if you compare Minnesota and Wisconsin in general, we're doing very well. Our population is growing faster. Our economic growth has been greater. But when you're right across the line, that's where there's a problem. Because, Moorhead versus Fargo, there is a problem. But Moorhead is actually doing extremely well now. We used to have property taxes on apartments that were much higher than Fargo. There were no apartments being built in Moorhead. We slashed those taxes like, what, two-thirds or something? We're now cheaper than Fargo. And, oh, boy, are there ever an awful lot of apartments being built in Moorhead? Because we're now cheaper. And in our border cities legislation, there is a provision for this disparity credit for apartments. But it's just in language now. Nothing happens there because we are considerably cheaper. And I think that would be the case with you, too. The apartments would be probably considerably cheaper, just like the housing is considerably cheaper.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Shedd.
Mr. Chairman, I haven't been on the committee for a while. Can you tell me, I assume that the disparity, is it a disparity reduction?
Credit.
Yeah. Is that, the whole circumference of our state, or is it just certain borders, and how are they defined?
Mr. Chair, it's along the North Dakota-South Dakota border. I think Ortonville is the only one along the South Dakota border, and it's where there are cities right across from each other, Wahpeton, Breckenridge, Moorhead, Fargo, Grand Forks, East Grand Forks.
Is it five cities, Senator Langstedt?
I believe Dilworth is in there too because they're right adjacent to Moorhead. I think it's five. Yeah.
Senator Shedd.
Then, Mr. Chairman, do we? What about Duluth? Do they have any?
No.
They don't. So okay.
Mr. Chair, I do have. We have Wade Vitalis, who is a business owner. I will say that Osceola has 17 Minnesota businesses in their industrial park that have crossed over, and but Wade has a Mr. Vitalis has a pretty compelling testimony as a business owner, especially on the retail side, competing against right across the river.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I grew up in Taylor's Falls, and
Your name.
Oh, my name is Wade Vitalis. Sorry about that. I grew up in Taylor's Falls. When I was 26 years old, I bought my first business, and I still own it after 21 years. I've been a member of the chamber that entire 21 years. I served on the chamber board, was chamber president for about 7 years. In 2001, the chamber encouraged the city to create an economic development commission, one of the reasons being this exact struggle that we have, which is where the rubber hits the road on tax policy for Minnesota and Wisconsin. And so I do appreciate the opportunity to present some information to you today. The mayor already talked about the map. I think it's important to note that the St. Croix River really is like a road that separates our two downtowns. So I'm competing with someone on the other side of the street that has a totally different tax situation than I do. I provided for you a comparison that shows Taylor's Falls, Wisconsin, a property in Taylor's Falls, Wisconsin, and a property in St. Croix Falls, Wisconsin. And it's in a kind of a column. Taylor's Falls is on the left. St. Croix Falls is on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side is my business. It's a drive-in restaurant. I have car hops and poodle skirts and sell root beers and hamburgers and french fries. And I also have a miniature golf course. It sits on less than 1 acre. And the total square footage of my buildings combined is about 1,600 square feet. My nearest competitor in Wisconsin, just across the bridge, has 2.5 acres, has a 16,000-square-foot building. What's important to note is that the assessed value in 2009 for my property was $395,000, and the building across was assessed at $339,000. My tax bill for 2009 will be $12,121 versus $6,568. Our issue is property taxes. I have to sell a lot of hamburgers and french fries to make up that difference in the base. And as everybody knows, your base expense kind of is fixed. You can't really change that. I'd have to generate roughly $30,000 in additional revenue just to make up the $6,000 more that I'm paying in property taxes. What's the other example that I have is a retail property that I own. And I bring that one up because in the last 5 years I've lost two businesses to downtown St. Croix Falls where they could lease land cheaper and benefit from all the other perks. My building in Taylor's Falls has about 1,600 square feet. A comparable building in Main Street, St. Croix Falls, has 3,800 square feet, so almost 2.5 times the space. If you go down to the property taxes I'm paying, still about 25% more in property taxes, which makes renting in Wisconsin cheaper. So retailers are going to look on Main Street, Wisconsin, before they come here. So the mayor's correct. We're looking to partner with the state of Minnesota to actually keep our tax revenue here. Those people that are now in St. Croix Falls, leaving my space empty, are paying sales tax in St. Croix Falls, and they're increasing values and paying property taxes over there. So I see this as a net plus for you guys and for us to work together by including us in the Border Cities legislation. Thank you.
Mr. Vitalis, thank you. On your handout, the Dell's House Restaurant, is there a typo there? I mean, is that building really 16,000 square feet?
It's 16,000 square feet. It's next to a hotel, so they have banquet facilities and a bar and large restaurant space.
And what happened there so that from 2002 to 2009, the assessed value of that building went down by $90,000. What happened?
Wisconsin reassesses every, I think, 5 years or 6 years, I believe, and so they just reassessed it downwards. It's never been closed. It's still in operation. They just reassessed it downwards. One of our issues is valuations. We're on the edge of the metro, and we see high property values. And if you look at the underlying economic capacity to generate revenue of any kind, sometimes the assessed values just don't match what the property can generate. And so I think Wisconsin's identified that, at least for sure in this building.
Senator Scott, maybe we should have the assessor here.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, I think you're right on, because you look at the doubling of the assessed value from his drive-in in 5 years, and if the testimony is correct about their business climate in that community, I don't see how that can be occurring.
That's a question I've asked our county assessor many times.
And what's been his response, Mr. Vitale?
His response has been is we have a formula that we need to follow, and the state requires us to be within, 100% of the value, and these are the formulas that we have, and this is what we do, and this is what we come up with. Because you can see that from 2004 to 2009, my property taxes went up by about $6,000. Most of it based on value. I didn't do any significant improvements during that period of time.
It's
just value.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogomar.
Could your property be sold for $400,000?
$395,000? Sure.
Can a Wisconsin property be sold for that $339,000, or could it be sold for more?
I don't know if it had a sale recently. That probably could be found out. I don't have an answer to that question.
Do you think it, Would you buy it for $339 or would you pay more for it?
Would I want to buy it? Yeah, you could probably buy it for $339. I don't know why not.
So, Mr. Vitalis, to Senator Pogmar's question,
mm-hmm.
could somebody buy your building for $395 and make your business work?
It would be hard, but they probably could. It's summer seasonal. There's no point in being open in Taylor's Falls in the winter because there's no business. So it's summer seasonal.
Well,
Senator, go ahead.
Oh, Mr. Chair, so what I heard is the values might be fairly accurate.
I don't know any other values other than the ones I've given, so I really don't know how to. I'm not being intentionally coy. I really don't know.
Mr. Chair, I would say that the Dallas House used to have the best popover muffins in the state of Wisconsin, but they did have a problem changing ownership. I mean, people were struggling in that facility. It was always good food, though, and but there has been ownership change, and I think that's kind of how the restaurant business goes, but it was a very stylish restaurant for the area. So I'd buy it for $330,000.
Senator Olstein, I'm a carpenter. I know how big 16,000 square feet is. That is a big footprint for a restaurant, and that is a big building to heat.
Yeah.
So there's got to be something more going on there than popovers. I mean, that would be a lot of popovers.
The walleye is pretty good, too.
What would that be, Mr. Chair?
I think Senator Pogmar, the committee might need a road trip to see what they're doing at this restaurant in St. Croix Falls, 16,000 square feet.
Well, we'd stop and eat in the Minnesota side. Though.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
We would give Minnesota our sales tax.
I'd also just like to point out, if you don't mind, there's another handout that I just wanted to identify for you folks. It's an industrial commercial tax comparison of Taylor's Falls, along with the other cities that are involved in the program and probably our nearest competitor for downtown, Stillwater. And it just shows you where our property tax is relative to those.
Do we have that one?
I don't think we have that.
Do we have that handle?
I don't think we do.
Give it to Dan.
We made copies of it.
Have it.
I'll get that one here.
This is the residential, residential. Kind of commercial, industrial.
You have something we make copies of? Maybe you can give us a narrative again. It compares.
Yeah, what it did is it showed Dilworth and Moorhead and all of the ones that are currently in the program, and it shows our taxes being the highest of everybody's, including if you go down to Stillwater, which is kind of a gulp for us. It's significant, the property tax difference. Stillwater's paying about $7,000 for a $300,000 property, and we're paying more. And so it's just a compelling argument on the property tax side why we need some relief.
You have any thoughts about why they'd be significantly lower in Stillwater than in Taylor's Falls?
Commercial property tax base for Chisago County is 5%. I mean, that's the truth. And it's not that our commercial industrial is so low. We've just been inundated over the last 15 years with residents moving out to find less expensive homes who have jobs in the cities, who shop in Forest Lake at the Walmart and the Target. We have a real train wreck in Chisago County long term, trying to get more business into Chisago County. And so when you have such a low commercial industrial tax base, everybody's taxes are higher. And so we have kind of a double whammy on the border.
Mr. Chair, 70% of our residents commute to the cities. And some of them now are commuting to Osceola, Wisconsin, too, to the industrial park there. But that is our problem, that our Mr. Vitalis is right. Our commercial industrial is way, way low.
We'll wait a minute for the handout, and then we'll stimulate some conversation.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, if I may, I sure appreciate the time that you guys are giving to Taylor's Falls on this issue. And I think it does bring up a bigger issue, is that, you know, we are competing in a kind of a regional area, and this, I know Mr. Ng's been kind of kind when he says that Positive Minnesota hasn't invested as much money, because he shared with me in the past that it's hard to go to these business shows and see Wisconsin having a real nice format or a PowerPoint or whatever to promote business in their state, and that's lacking from Positive Minnesota. So I appreciate anything that you guys could do to try and stimulate that end of it.
It looks like Stillwater is kind of the outlier.
And Mr. Chair, I'm surprised at Dilworth and Breckenridge. I would have thought that with the Border Cities thing, that might have been different.
Mr. Chairman, I think Chris Ng would have a really good example of a business that just moved to Osceola and the reason why they were drawn there, some of the reasons why.
Mr. Ng?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Last night I was with the Schaefer Economic Development Authority, and one of the new members on the Schaefer EDA is a resident of Schaefer, and his name is Charles Miller. And he has a company by the name of Wavon Technologies, and it's a high-tech company that was in the city of Lindstrom leasing some space. They outgrew their space and ended up looking at other opportunities and chose Osceola, Wisconsin. The primary reason for that, they said, was because Minnesota did not have the resources to offer them in terms of technology seed funds to help with commercializing their new technology and help with marketing. And on top of that, they were offered a free building and free land, and it was just too good of a deal for them to pass up. They wanted to be in Minnesota. Charles last night said if he had the opportunity to come down and talk to you directly, he would be willing to testify. Talking about the advantages of being in Wisconsin and how his business is benefiting from being 6 miles across the river.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogler.
Is this pre or post Border Cities for Dilworth and Breckenridge and Moorhead?
Mr. Chair, this is obviously not taking that into consideration because it's a rigid 2.3% of value. So the $300,000 would be a little less than $7,000.
After the Border Cities credit?
After the credit.
Okay. Anybody have any thoughts what's going on in Stillwater?
Mr. Chairman, if I could again, I think Mr. Vitalis was right. If you look at the commercial industrial market values of Washington County, they're probably one of the highest in the state, I would suspect. Chisago County at 5% of the total overall market values is probably one of the lowest counties. And so I think from that perspective alone, they've got the business base to spread it out over more businesses, and whereas in Chisago County and in other counties, they don't have that capability.
I think members I'll have staff get us the tax rates for Washington and Chisago County, and then we'll look at the tax rates of Taylor's Falls and Stillwater and see, and the school levies, and see maybe what looks so different there. It does seem pretty odd. I mean, Washington County is closer to the Twins. If it's a Twin City impact, I mean, Washington County is closer to the Twin Cities, and you would think would reflect higher market values than further north.
And it is possible, Mr. Chairman, that it may be related to fiscal disparities as well. I couldn't tell you for sure.
In that Woodbury area, too, a lot of that commercial development's all TIF. All TIF. Acres and acres and acres.
Senator Rest, would that development have happened without TIF?
Yes. It's prime commercial property.
Senator Lemmer.
Mr. Chairman, in the testimony today, there was a reference to how county assessors assess value. And the reference was that the state requires a formula. I think it would be helpful for our committee to see how that the department operates and what kind of formula it uses. I'm sure there's other people that will have concerns over the business owners and developers that are comparing one state to another. I'd like to know how the state formulates some of the values. And if the department could maybe bring that to our committee, that would be
Senator Limmer, the commissioner is going to be up shortly. I'm sure that he can, whether we have Mr. Haugen here or somebody from the department, that can explain the sales ratio. If we can't get that discussion today, maybe we can we can do it later, sometime later. But. Senator Squay?
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, to that point, they use some kind, sometimes they use an income formula, and sometimes they use a highest and best use. And it would be real interesting to visit with some assessors about what the criteria are for determining which standard they're going to use and where it's going to go.
I in my district, I'm getting a number of complaints from constituents and home and business owners that say, why is it that our property values have consistently gone down in this market condition over 3, 4, 5 years, but our property taxes are continuing to rise? And there's a concern by the public, and they need to have an answer to that, or we need to fix it.
I think, Senator Limmer, there's a misconception on the part of the public that your property taxes are actually tied to your value.
Then why have an assessed market value that is required through a formula by the assessors?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest?
Well, Senator Limmer, value, I mean, it's, as the chairman said, value of the property is only one element in determining property tax. I mean, Minnesota sets out differences in who owns the property, what it's used for, what the local government's budgets are. I mean, there are any number of, you know, if something that looks like a house could be a business, so it's commercial property. I mean, it's not just a single factor. And if a local government needs to raise $1 million and the property values are jumping all around within the property that's in their city, yeah, but if they need to raise $1 million and every single property value goes down, their taxes aren't going to change at all, everything else being equal. So if they still have to raise $1 million, your taxes may go up.
You're assuming I'm raising the question.
Right.
Well, no, I'm responding to your constituents' concerns, Mr. Chairman, Senator Limmer.
I'm not sure if they're going to be satisfied with that answer.
But it's the law.
When they lose 20% of value, they can't sell their property for even 80% of it was of the value that it was maybe 3, 4 years ago, and they see their taxes going up. I think the public has a point of view that our taxes follow the assessed tax assessment that's been done on their property.
I think that's
just not true.
That is what people think.
It's not true.
But more and more people are going to come to learn that there is a very small linkage, very small, in what happens to your market value and what happens to your property taxes. They really are not connected. I think people think they are.
They're one element. They're one element, but they're not the whole. They're not the whole story.
Senator Limmer, I drove through Maple Grove on Saturday. A lot of development out there. How much of that new, all that big new development is TIF out there?
There's no TIF there.
None.
No, they haven't relied on TIF for about a long time, 15 years.
Different than Woodbury, Senator Rest.
I think so.
Maple Grove is a very popular place to put a business, and they don't need it.
Mr. Chairman.
That intersection.
Mr. Chairman, and could we have a conversation about coefficient of dispersion for Senator Limmer? That's one of my favorite topics. Just don't make me explain it. But
you can visit my office, and we can talk about that.
Senator Olsen, anything further?
Well, Mr. Chair, I realize the time we've spent on this, but I think it's been a good discussion about, you know, maybe a little beyond Taylor's Falls and kind of how we are a state in our region, and I think it's a very positive discussion. But please don't forget Taylor's Falls.
Mr. Paulson just handed me the net tax capacity. The rate in Washington County is about 80, and in Chisago it's about 109. So we'll make a copy of this for everybody so they can see it. Senator Olsen, anything further?
That should do it. Thank you.
Any other questions, members of the committee? If not, thank you.
Chair, we have a chance, and I'm sure we will, to talk about this a bit more because I think we're delving into some important areas. And I'm not specifically on this bill, but
I think, Senator, in a general way. We should have a discussion about whether we should have the department come in and kind of talk about the relationship between property taxes as it relates to people's market values moving around. Might actually be helpful to do that someday we're on television when some people can see. And get a good explanation from the department about how your property taxes are or are not linked to the market value of your property.
Mr. Chair, I could, and I suspect every city is a little different. I happen to live in one where, frankly, we have out-of-state investors in, investing in my city commercially in large part, apparently, and I can't remember the tax law, but it to avoid certain capital gains incumbencies that they might occur unless they reinvest. And they have to do that in a certain timeline, so they pay inflated values. And so we've got this inflated property in town, which then tends to spur up all of the valuations on the existing properties. And I will tell you at the last tax and, truth and taxation hearings in Olmsted County were pretty ugly because of this phenomena. But it does occur.
Is that like-kind exchanges? And
What is it? Is it a 520?
Oh,
1031
exchanges.
1031, yeah.
I think there is a serious question whether they are impacting future assessed values.
They may not in every town, but they are in some.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the committee. You know, this has been an interesting discussion that we had about the values of houses and their property taxes, but for much of rural Minnesota, kind of welcome to our world. We've been struggling with declining housing values for a number of years with increasing property taxes. This is not a new phenomenon for folks in the rural part, and it's a real challenge for local governments to provide services under that scenario because, you know, their values are in the housing in their communities are going down. And the other communities are picking it up to some degree, but it's a real challenge. And, you know, maybe when the department comes, we'd have a chance to visit with some of that. The other thing I'd like to have the department, when they talk about, when we talk about these assessors and how their mechanisms work, is to focus in a little bit on the CI's valuation mechanism, see what the consistencies are there.
Any other questions, members? If not, Senator Olsen, thank you. Chair lays over Senate File 103 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you. Members, I think we're going to, Senator Marty, is it okay if we have the commissioner come up first? Senator Marty and Senator Pogel are on the committee, so the commissioner has to get over to the House for a hearing at 10:30, so members, let's continue our discussion with the commissioner on the governor's tax budget. Commissioner?
Chairman, thank you. My name is Ward Ines with the Department of Revenue. And maybe first and foremost, to Senator Limmer's point about bringing this, our assessment specialists in, Gordon Folkman, Hagen, and some others, to talk about both residential valuations, commercial industrial methodology on their valuations, because Senator Rest is absolutely right. And we spent a lot of time in the last 12 months talking to homeowners and property owners about the impact of valuation changes on their net property taxes, because there is a misunderstanding about how important a component that is. I mean, maybe the most important thing is what Senator Rest was hitting on, the mix of properties in the jurisdiction, what your property is doing relative to the other properties in the jurisdiction. And so there's a lot of moving parts in our property tax system. Valuation is just one of those. You know, we have the phase out of limited market value still being undertaken. There's just a lot of moving parts. So having Mr. Hagen come in and Mr. Folkman come in and talk about those and how determinative they are on your property tax would be very, I think, beneficial, especially in this market. And we've been talking with assessors a lot because we're on uncharted territory. You know, one of our general rules in the past has been a property that's a distressed property that's in foreclosure should not be used for purposes of the sales ratio study. Well, you have jurisdictions now in North Minneapolis where the majority of the sales are distressed sales. They're short sales. They're, you know, foreclosures. So what do you do in that environment where the majority of the sales are, in fact, distressed sales and may represent the market value in that community? So it's uncharted territory for us as well in some respects. So it's been a challenge, and it might be good for all of us to have maybe a discussion about what the world looks like out there right now from an assessment standpoint.
Mr. Chair.
So, Commissioner, could you go back and talk with your staff and see kind of how long it would take them to prepare? Maybe we could dedicate one committee hearing, 2 hours, to kind of what's going on relative to property taxes, relative to assessed values, maybe some of the criteria assessors are using, maybe where we have – assessors have an awful lot of latitude.
They do. You know, and we really play an oversight role at the department, primarily via our sales ratio study. And then we have the capability to issue board orders. If there's an assessor we think is an outlier who's not really doing their job, we can do that. We issue those board orders very rarely. Our assessing community in general is very good. But it's a complicated process. There's no question about it. And I kind of laughed about Senator Pogelmeier's comment because in the past, oftentimes we get complaints about assessed valuations, the same ones I think a lot of you legislators get. But my question always is, would you sell the property for that? And more often than not, the answer is absolutely not. It's worth way more than that. You know, so that's kind of the discussion you need to have. I think in this marketplace, it's a very it's a different world out there right now.
Commissioner, I hear that from cabin owners in my district all the time.
Yeah.
But if you could check with them and maybe get back to the committee staff on when they could have a couple-hour presentation put together, I think it would be a good exercise for all of us, and we'll see if we can make an effort to make sure it's televised so that the public could participate in learning something about our discussion. Senator Limmer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to get the commissioner on his way on the show, but one comment that Commissioner, you made about a whole region of an urban area that has so many properties that are now in foreclosure or in some type of duress. Look carefully at how the mortgage industry works, because the appraisers on those mortgage values that they need to determine are recognizing all of the foreclosure sales as the market condition. And they will not give a value higher than what the neighboring properties are. That's the real world. That's how the real private sector is working, and it would be, I think, advantageous to the state of Minnesota, or at least to the homeowners and taxpayers, to recognize how the private sector works. If we get too far away from what the private sector is doing, then we might as well just throw away the market assessed value from our county assessors and create some magic formula that can at least on paper justify some other value. So as you study that, I would suggest look at how the private sector appraisers are valuing things in relationship to what the banks are willing to invest in a mortgage on that property. And if we're $20,000, $30,000 apart from a residential price, in a low-price neighborhood like, you know, some parts of Minneapolis, where there's a field of foreclosure homes in the area that surround, hundreds of them are around, that is the market condition of the real world. And we probably, as a state, should reflect real-world values.
And Chairman Senator Limmer, the point's very well taken. I mean, there's the general rule is that we assess properties at what they would get in an arm's length transaction. So we do our best to try to duplicate what the free market is indicating, what the value of that asset is. With this uncertainty in the housing market and the property market in general, it's become more of a challenge than ever. I mean, assessment is as much an art as a science in some respects. And the best assessors kind of balance out both and do a good job, I think, in general. But points very well taken.
Commissioner? And members, the governor's budget information, you have that. So, Commissioner, where did we leave off? I think we were getting pretty close to LGA.
Yep, we were, Chairman. Chairman, I think we were just beginning to talk about the property tax components of the governor's recommendations, which start on page 14 with the county program aid reduction. And maybe I'll just talk about the overall package of how we came to arrive at our decisions regarding the LGA county program aid market value credit. We structured this proposal in much the same way we structured the 2003 LGA and county program aid cuts. We backloaded the cuts into the second year, acknowledgement that cities and counties have a limited amount of budgetary flexibility for the levies that have already been set. So two-thirds of the cut will come in the second year, one-third of the cut in the first year. We've also capped those cuts as a percentage of levy plus aid. So no, there's not the disproportionate cuts for cities and counties. In year one, Chairman, the cities are capped at 5.05% of levy plus aid, and in year two, 10.55% of levy plus aid. For purposes of the counties, they are capped at 1.53% of levy plus aid in the first year, and then in pay 2010, they're capped at 2.8% of levy plus aid in the second year. Now, there's a wrinkle on the county program aid, which many of you have heard about, is that the cut can be bought back if the counties agree to consolidate some of their health and human services functions. And the Department of Health and Human Services is drafting that component of the package, what will be required of the counties in order to buy back a percentage of their aid. We're assuming that the benchmarks will be met. We've talked to the counties. It's a work in progress. I think we're, you know, kind of talking to them on an ongoing basis. My understanding, though, that the first benchmark will be in November this year, where the counties will just have to demonstrate to the Department of Health and Human Services that they're gonna participate in this consolidation endeavor, and then in May or June of 2010, they'll need to pass a resolution and submit that to the department, and then in the following year they'll have to sign off on a joint powers agreement to finalize that agreement. If they meet all those benchmarks, they will buy back the percent of their aid, and that percentage amount or that dollar amount is indicated in the change item. It's the $25 million in 2010. And the $32 million in 2011. So it's trying to get some of these services consolidated rather than having 87 separate health human services delivery systems out there, consolidate these into 15 delivery systems. And it's something the Department of Health and Human Services, along with the counties, AMC, are working on to make a workable solution. The LGA cuts, as I said, are capped at 5.05 in the first year and 10.55. Now, townships are also receiving a cut on the market value credit, and there was an oversight in our budget that we're going to address in the supplemental budget. Both the counties and the cities have caps on the percent of levy plus aid they can lose. We neglected to put a cap on the townships, and that was just an oversight on our part. So we'll come back in our supplemental budget. And we'll have a cap for the townships, so they're not disproportionately cut. We found out after doing the runs that about 30% of the townships would receive cuts greater than 10% of their levy plus aid under our initial proposal. So that was never our intent. We wanted to make sure they're proportional to the counties and the cities. So we'll come back in our supplemental budget, Chairman, and have a cap for the townships that will mitigate some of the cuts for those townships.
Commissioner, it looks like, correct me if I'm wrong, that the LGA cut is about 23% of LGA. I mean, the criticism that I've heard from cities is they understand the state has a serious budget problem. They're willing to participate in that, but they think it's unfair for them to participate to a greater extent than other areas of the budget are. I mean, aren't we really disproportionately having an impact on cities here and holding other things to a much lower level of cuts, or maybe holding some things harmless, so that is really the share being spread equally around the state budget, or are local governments being asked to carry a disproportionate share of the burden of balancing the state budget?
Chairman, you're accurate. 23% is the biennium cut for the LGA, and that is greater than the 15% general fund deficit that we're confronted with. When the governor was constructing his budget, he did a hierarchy of priorities. And all spending in the budget he didn't deem as equal, I suppose, in his hierarchy of priorities. K-12 would have been at the top of his hierarchy. Higher ed would have been higher probably than LGA. So it's not to say LGA doesn't play an important role in our state and fiscal, you know, relationship. I think when we're making some very difficult decisions, there were some other spending priorities that he just put more emphasis on than local government aid.
But Commissioner, I'm sure I've heard the governor say that one of his top three priorities, and I won't rank the three, but one of the top three priorities he listed was public safety. And I'm just wondering, I mean, on behalf of the city of Duluth that I represent part of, along with Senator Solon, how is a $7 million cut in local government aid not going to impact public safety? I don't understand how the governor continued to make that argument that he's going to protect public safety when in cities like Duluth, that's a heavily LGA-dependent city, it fits the criteria, old city, old infrastructure. How is there not going to be an impact,
I think, Chairman,
on public safety?
Chairman, one of the reasons why we backloaded the aid cuts is in recognition of that. I mean, in the first year, the aid cut will not be any greater than 5.05% of the levy plus aid. So we believe that a 5% cut should be able to be effectuated without cutting core services like police, fire, and public safety. In the second year, they'll have the opportunity to levy back and use a special levy that you were an advocate for. That's part of the levy limits. And they can put as much on that special levy as possible for police and fire. So we think the first year cut is the important one. It's only 5% of levy plus aid. We think most cities and public officials can make a 5% cut without sacrificing police and fire.
But, Commissioner, aren't we asking cities that are dependent on LGA to make a 5% cut while we're asking cities that don't depend on state aid to make about a 2% cut? I mean, how is that spreading the pain between communities that have low tax capacities or old infrastructure or whatever they have in the formula? How is that equitably spreading, sharing the pain of the state budget cuts when we ask one group of cities to participate at a 2% level and another group to participate at 5% and then next year at a 10% level?
Well, Chairman, we try to construct this LGA market value credit county program aid proposal in a way that spread the cuts around to as broad a universe of cities and jurisdictions as possible. The reality is, though, a city like Edina doesn't get any LGA, and they get a very nominal amount of market value credit because most of their homes are over the $414,000 where it phases out. So, you know, we took everything we could that they get from the state. I mean, there's only so much you can take. So we did our best to try to, you know, spread the pain around as far as these cuts. But the reality is some of these jurisdictions just don't get much in the way of state aid in the form of LGA or market value credit. So we were limited at what we could do as far as spreading it any more than we already have. So it's true, there is some disparity. Some cities are at the 5%, some are at the 1%. But that was just the nature of where the aid goes and how it flows in different jurisdictions.
Can I ask him to write a check?
Senator Rest, any suggestions?
Is that what we should do? Should we ask Edina to write a check to the state government so they can share the sacrifice?
Put in the bill.
Chairman, Senator Rust, we did not consider that. We did not.
No, obviously not.
So, Commissioner, are there cities that lost all of their market value credit?
There are. There are quite a few cities that lost all their market value credit. I think Lakeville. I mean, a lot of the suburban cities lost 100% of their market value credit. I've been criticized by representatives of those communities saying they think market value credit is a very different animal than LGA, and that if we don't get LGA, we should be unscathed. I made the argument that we're trying to be as equitable as possible with these cuts, and market value credit needs to be in the mix. So there's some skin in the game for all communities. So I've gotten criticized by both representatives of those affluent suburbs, and I've been criticized by the LGA-dependent community. So I think it's a fairly well-balanced, and it's consistent with how we've done it in the past as well. And I wanted to, you know, we didn't want to throw a curveball at communities. We wanted the structure in the way that they've adapted to in the past. and we think it's a fair and balanced way of approaching it.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Langsdorff.
Mr. Chair, what I hear from the cities is quite a bit of resentment over the fact that the governor is saying if the property taxes go up, that's the decision they made. I think that's unfair, and they think it's very unfair because we know those property taxes are going to be going up. And for us to say that it had nothing to do with what we did here, I think is I'm certainly not going to say that. And I kind of think the governor should back off a little bit on that because I think it's something like 60% of the budgets for the cities is public safety. And, you know, that 5% cut is obviously, well, particularly when you get to the 10%, is obviously going to cut into that unless they raise taxes. So I don't think we should try to fool anybody into saying that that we're going to come out of here in a way that the cities don't have to raise property taxes.
And Chairman, Senator Langsdorff, I wouldn't sit here and say the decisions that are made in this committee and this legislature have no impact on local units of government. Ultimately, the decision is a local decision and what they want to do, but you're right. They have only so many levers to pull. LGA is one of those levers. County Program Aid is another lever. And so to say that there's no impact on these decisions on local property tax levy, I won't go that far. I do think that with the help of Senator Bach and others, we put some we improved on the levy limits. You know, we have philosophical differences about the efficacy and you know, the philosophy behind levy limits, but I think some of the things that Senator Bach brought to the table, a special levy for foreclosure costs associated with foreclosures, a special levy for police and fire is a key one. But you know, less than half the counties and less than half the cities took advantage of that special levy. So I was a little surprised at that because it was there because Senator Bach advocated hard for it. So I think there's elements of the levy limits, there's elements built in that gives communities some breathing room when it comes to public safety and some of these other costs that they are beyond their control.
Commissioner, I got to tell you, I'm a little concerned. I mean, I know small cities because that's where I live. And I think I know something about the metropolitan area. I live here 6 months a year. But the little city that I'm from, that I grew up in, this winter got rid of their police department. They decided they could no longer afford to have a police department. And now public safety in the little town that I'm from, Commissioner, is a 911 phone call. And I am very concerned about that as that starts to happen to more small cities across the state, that doesn't seem like public safety, a 911 phone call. It seems like there should be more to providing that than just after the emergency happens. And I'm a little concerned that that's the direction that we're heading because of the issue of declining property values and now reduced help from the state. I think we're headed in a troubling direction, Commissioner, and I just want to raise that with you. That happened in my little small town. I talked to a newspaper editor in another small town I represent. He said they're likely going to go, that community's likely going to go the same direction and get rid of their police department. That's problematic. Senator Double?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's worth just taking note of the fact that current biennium through unallotments and cuts, significant reductions in local government aid. And, you know, we'll see the consequence for that quite immediately. You know, City of Minneapolis already having to significantly revise its established budget, $13 million, on top of $16 million in cuts already taken. That's going to have tremendous impact on the ability to deliver core public safety, core public works, you know, core essential city services. City services are those services that touch our communities the most and are the closest to quality of life that we enjoy on an everyday, day-in, day-out basis.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Schein.
Mr. Chairman, what concerns me is that the governor is suggesting that, well, it'll, or maybe through the commissioner, is saying we're going to let you levy back some of this in the next year, the next biennium. And I think most people agree that the property tax is the least fair tax, the least popular tax, certainly. And I think it's one of it's the least fair. So to say that we don't raise taxes on Minnesotans, I think it's somewhat disingenuous. I don't, you know, to pretend that we're not going to raise the costs for people who live in Minnesota. And I can call it whatever you want. I suppose local decision-making about whether or not they're going to keep a police officer patrolling or having a presence in your small town or not, and what, you know, what other impacts or what are the consequences of that, or are they going to be big spenders and levy for it? You know, I just don't think it's fair to criticize our local government for trying to provide the services that I think Minnesotans just expect. And I represent two communities that have significant public safety issues. I live four doors from a house where shots have been fired several times this fall. I hate to think that the 108 police calls to the property that's owned and not rented, which means it raises all kinds of other challenges to a community. Hate to think that they couldn't make, I mean, they've made more than 108 now. That was in December. I think we have to just not pretend that local governments can just go merrily on their way and cut spending, and it's not going to have an impact on people. It is going to have an impact, and it is going to raise property taxes, and at the end of the day, people will be paying higher taxes, albeit not, you know, sales or gas tax or income tax or corporate income tax. But I just think we just have to make that point. And, of course, it would be nice to see that acknowledgement from the West Wing.
Chairman, Senator Scheid, your point's very well taken. I mean, there's no question that the number one priority for every local unit of government is public safety. Absolutely number one priority. But just like the state, we're trying to do our best. Our priorities in a very tough economic environment. We're making a 15% general fund reduction. I mean, we're doing some things, you know, some one-time money. We're trying to mitigate the cuts. But we're it's a 15% delta that we need to address. And asking cities to do a 5% cut of their levy plus aid in the first year and a 10% cut is not out of bounds with what we're asking the state to do and what the delta the state has to address. And I think most citizens are pretty rational people. And if their city or county comes to them and says, no, we have to increase your levy by X amount in order to provide public safety, they'll give them the green light on that. And so I'm just hopeful that at the local level you're not going to see those kind of cuts, because either the local government can prioritize to make it the highest and best priority it needs to be, more higher priority than parks, higher priority than fixing potholes, higher priority than anything else is public safety. But then if they're really in a bind and need to raise their levy, I think most citizens are going to say, yeah, I want to keep that police officer on the beat. And go ahead and increase the property taxes to do that.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator,
Mr. Chairman, just let's not lose the connection here. I mean, that we are going to raise, property taxes will go up. Not because any of us in this room, including yourself, want them to, but at the end of the day, cuts in state aid are going to cause property taxes to go up, and that's not my first choice.
And Chairman, Senator Scheid, it's not our first choice either, but there was an explicit acknowledgement last year when we did the levy limits that by the governor that public safety needs to be protected, and he agreed to that special levy because of it. You know, Senator Bach made a very persuasive case that we need to do this, and he knows the importance of public safety. So that special levy is in place. We have no intention of adjusting it or asking for its repeal or anything. We think that's an important part of the levy limits that we put in place.
Commissioner, if it was so important, why did the governor make me work so hard to get it? Senator Scoy.
Oh, well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Commissioner. I heard you just say that the state is making a 15% reduction in spending. My recollection of what Commissioner Hansen presented was a 2.2% reduction in spending, and the billion of that 2.2 is actually the tobacco loan for loan payment stuff. So what is exact going on there?
Right. I misspoke of Senator Chairman, Senator Scully. I misspoke. That's the case. I just said we have a deficit that's equivalent of 15% of general fund revenues. And I acknowledge that some of it's one-time money, some of it, you know, it's not completely spending cuts. But even having said that, the cuts that we're doing, I mean, they're tough cuts. There's no question. I mean, the governor's first preference wasn't to cut LGA by 23%. I mean, he knows that's a sensitive issue both politically and from a policy perspective. You know, he knows we're not back at the pre-2003 funding levels when it comes to LGA. He understands that. But when you looked at the whole universe of the budget and you said, no, where I'm going to make cuts, is it going to be K-12 or LGA? In his world of hierarchies, which I concur with, K-12 is a higher priority than LGA.
Well, and Mr. Chair, some of these communities that have a significant portion of their budget coming from LGA, when you take the 10% in the second year of the biennium, they will be experiencing significantly larger percentage reductions in their budget than the state is. And they still have, you know, half of their budget is public safety. So there's just no way that this is not going to impact public safety in those communities. And, you know, to be honest, Senator Bach talked about his community. You know, the county that I live in, it's 60 miles long and 20-some miles wide. For 12 hours every night, all week long, there's one deputy covering that 1,200 square miles or whatever it is. And, you know, how that community is going to deal with this reduction, is I don't know. But they certainly have to have at least one deputy covering that area at night. So what part of that are they going to cut?
Commissioner, I hope in the supplemental budget you can do better.
We will try, Chairman. We will try. I think we've gone over most of the property tax components and how that's structured. Feel free to ask any additional questions. I guess page 19 is the next substantive recommendation of the governor's, and that's the elimination of the political contribution refund. I know he's proposed this in the past. I think both in 2003 and maybe 2005, this has been part of the governor's budget. And as you can see, that would raise about, well, $4.8 million in 2010 and $6.8 million in 2011.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Scheid.
Mr. Chairman, that was enacted in a bill I carried. I'm taking this very personally, and it's very painful. after the feds cut out the political contribution tax credit, I wanted to get it back for Minnesota, and this was actually the Commissioner of Revenue. I can't put my finger on who it was, and Governor Perpich did not. We had gone a long way in simplifying our form, the state income tax form, and did not want to add a line back to it. So we went to this. We went this route of the PCR, and I think there's a lot of people that still don't understand it's really just a tax credit. It just you don't have to wait till April 15th or till when you file your state income tax. That will be painful to see that go. I suppose I don't have a whole lot of hope here, even with the committee, but I worked hard to get that back.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Rest.
Chairman, I think we are going to have to consider this part of the proposal very seriously. On the other hand, I think we should also, although it's not the purview of this committee, to look at the checkoff. And right now the checkoff is an opt-in. And it seems to me that the trade there, and a very reasonable one, is to make it an opt-out. And if you don't choose, then it goes into the general party accounts or the general account specifically for supporting candidates. Mm-hmm. Also, in the political contribution refund, if we're really talking about it supporting candidates running for office, and I would think both parties will not like what I'm going to say, but not make it available for our political parties. Let them raise their money some other way. But there are, and I think also the political contribution, the checkoff as another budget-saving thing should be used to finance the campaign finance board, and we can take away their general fund appropriation. I mean, there are some opportunities to make the whole system of public financing of campaigns, whether it's through this or the checkoff, the way we deal with the campaign finance board. They should become an enterprise fund, I think. But, you know, it's $44.8 million. You can either just reduce the deficit that way, that much, or you can spend that $4.8 million better, and people just have to understand that making contributions to campaigns is not free. And it is, it's an opportunity to participate, and it involves a sacrifice.
And, Mr. Chairman, I was just whining.
Well,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed that this comes after the governor has raised a lot of money last year. Just noticed that. So it's interesting timing. But, you know, the political contribution refund isn't just about supporting candidates. It's about everything that goes with that program. Someone who agrees to public financing also agrees to limiting the amount of dollars that they take from particular sources, the large contributors, the PACs, the lobbyists, and the like. So, you know, it's more than just.
Same thing's true with the checkoff.
Getting money to, you know, to candidates. It's about, you know, trying to institute some level of broadening who contributes and addresses the role of money, power, and influence in our political system so that hopefully and ideally candidates are responding to a broad array of interests and not just a narrow band of interests. So this is more than just about getting money into candidates and into parties. And so I'm dubious and skeptical of this proposal, not supportive.
Senator Double, you'll remember that the House last year eliminated this program in their tax bill and brought it to conference.
I remember that. That was a bad idea.
And Chairman, Senator Double, the governor's record, this is the third time the governor's taken a run at this program. So if the legislature had gone along and passed this, that no, the issue about him raising money via this credit would be a mute issue. He's advocated consistently. We question whether a dollar for dollar, it's called a tax credit, but it's more of a political contribution grant program is what it is, because it's a dollar for dollar refundable, I guess, tax credit, but it's not really a tax credit. It's more analogous to a grant, up to $100 for a married couple and $50 for an individual, and we just wonder if that is a good use of resources, especially in these economic times.
Commissioner, I think we skipped over page 18.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, we did. This is one also a governor has advocated for in the past. This is a change in the renter's credit. To refresh your memory, the renter credit is currently calibrated as 19%. It's assumed that for the purpose of the renter's credit, it's 19% of your rent is the rent paid. We did a study in 2005 that indicated that 19% should be something closer to 15%. And what really the reason this has come about is that in 2001 we did a substantial reduction in apartment property taxes, Senator Langs has alluded to, and we never recalibrated the renter's credit to take into account that fairly dramatic, I think a 30% reduction in apartment property taxes. So the renter's credit has really morphed into a property tax refund program and a rent subsidy. And so we are advocating that it be taken down to 15%, which are the most recent evidence, which is 2005, indicates is probably the tipping point. Many properties are below that as far as percent of rent paid is 13 or 12%. But there's geographical variation throughout the state, so we think 15% is probably the appropriate tipping point for that lender's credit.
Senator Restrepo.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, the problem, you know, we've gone back and forth with whether we want landlords to bear the burden of figuring out what each unit in their apartment building, the percentage of the rent that is due to taxes. They complained mightily about that. They said put in a surrogate formula that is a percentage of the rent, and we have flip-flopped over the years a number of times, and now it's percentage of the rent. It is indeed a housing subsidy because it is not linked to property taxes. However, when it was, and then we gave, again, in 2001, the property tax break on rental properties, we didn't see necessarily rents reflecting the break that or the relief that the apartment owners or owners of rental properties had received through their taxes. And instead of rents going down, reflecting that, they stayed the same as if 19% of the rent was going to property taxes. So I think we need to be very careful about adjusting this percentage. If the property tax relief had been passed on to the renters, then there's a really good case. But I think we can find that it hasn't been particularly passed on to renters. And even in the year after that, when the most dramatic effect would have been felt, they didn't see any reduction in their rents. So I don't mind calling it a renting subsidy because it isn't tied directly to property taxes, although it's supposed to be a surrogate. But when it was started, that was what it was supposed to be related to because renters pay taxes too. So I'm going to be very reluctant to change this percentage, certainly as dramatically as you do here.
Well, Senator Rest, if it's not being passed on to the renters, why again wouldn't we reduce this to reflect the percentage that the landlord is paying in property tax? I'm not getting your argument for not doing this, especially as you argued that it's not being passed on to renters.
What will happen in addition is that the rents will or what has happened is the rents did not keep pace with the renter's credit. This is something that's applied for by the renter, has nothing to do with the landlord. I mean, the certificate of rent paid is just that. And then they get the renter's credit off of that as if it was supposed to be a property tax refund, but it no longer is. But when we touted it as one, and we said, "Oh well, we're going to do property tax reform and reduce apartment rates and so forth." If the property tax relief at that point, at the owner's level, had been reflected in reduced rents, then the commissioner has a point. But the fact of the matter is, it wasn't. So they're paying rents as if 19% of their rent is indeed a property tax. So who gets the benefit here? Not the renter.
Mr. Chair,
Alexa.
I'll have to say in my area what it did. In the city of Moorhead, they went from having no rental units being built to, 100 to 200 units a year being built. So I think it had a very positive effect. I won't say the rents went down, but the way it was, many of the college students were living in Fargo, from Moorhead State and Concordia College because there was the rental available. And now, so there was a building boom because of the reduction.
That's true.
And so I think, at least for my area, it was very much a positive.
Also, Mr. Chairman and Senator Langseth, the other thing that happened in as a positive effect of lowering that rate is that apartment owners who had been putting off maintenance and repairs were able to use the dollars that were coming from a reduction in the apartment rates or rental unit rates to accomplish maintenance and repairs that they hadn't been able to do before. And, you know, that was a good thing from it, as well as the incentive to build more. But when you look at what the renters are doing and the impact on them, it directly, so they're in a better maintained building, okay, but they didn't get any reduction in their rents either.
Chairman, can I comment on this issue briefly? You know, I think Senator Langsess is absolutely right that what this did spur, the 30% reduction in property taxes, was development, not just in the border communities either. I think everywhere. And we don't know what rents would have done if we hadn't done the property tax reduction. We don't know what they would have done. And I think programs should do what programs were intended to do. And this was meant to be a property tax refund program. And if the legislature thinks that we need to have a rent subsidy program, then we should create a rent subsidy program, because this is a very efficient way at providing a rent subsidy. I mean, if you wanted to siphon off the savings and create
Let's
a
go
rent.
Back to property taxes paid, then. Make the apartment owners
And I think that's a more compelling argument. That, I mean, there's administrative cost with that. There's a hassle factor with landlords. But if you really wanted to accurately target the property tax refund, these renters, that's the optimal way to do it. But I do think programs need to be retooled over time. And if this is meant to be something other than a property tax refund program, then maybe we need to acknowledge that and create something that is better at targeting a rent subsidy than this program. Because right now, everybody is getting this. Whether you're living in a, you know, whether you can afford the rent or not afford the rent, you're getting this rent subsidy. So it's a very shotgun approach to providing a rent subsidy. So I'm a big believer on, you know, make it a property tax refund program. If you want to do a rent subsidy, do a rent subsidy, but don't blend the two in this particular program.
Commissioner, do you have any idea how, if it actually was tied to actual cost of property taxes for the unit, how it might score? Has the department looked at that?
Yeah, we have not scored it exactly, but I am confident that it would raise more money than the $50 million that going to 15% would raise. Because if you look at the survey, there was a large concentration, especially in rural areas, where the percent of rent paid is around 10%. So if we actually went to, you know, the more surgical approach of paying out this renter's credit, I think the savings, and we should score that just for edification, but I'm convinced it'll be substantially higher than the $50 million.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Estes.
Commissioner, the folks that benefit from both the property tax refund and the homeowners refund, what's the population demographic, geographic distribution a number of people who are eligible and receive it? And I would assume that in the metropolitan area there's more dollars in it, but in terms of beneficiaries of it, that would be interesting for us to know relative to your proposal.
Chairman, Senator Rest, we'll get that information.
I know. Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah. Commissioner, I think we'll probably be asking you to score that for us.
We'll do that. Duly noted.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator
Mr. Chairman, this may not be the right place, but I'm also, I represent two communities that are very much affected by 4D classification. In fact, when we went to 4D, I argued against it because every apartment unit in the district I represent was already had lower rents than the HUD guideline for 4D, so that was being used. So I don't know if the department can measure that in different communities or not, but that is kind of an issue for me as well.
Chairman, I do know from working on the 4D issue that there was certain communities that had high concentrations of the 4D, and we can look into that to see how it would impact going to, you know, the actual percent of rent paid in different communities that have high concentration of 4D.
Senator Rest.
One more comment back to Senator Shy. Just like you were the author of the political contribution
oh, no.
refund. Guess who authored 4D?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogomar, why don't you join in?
Well, I was just going to say, aren't these the two members of the new members of the committee? And they seem to.
And their previous work is now under scrutiny.
Ripped apart.
It was very dignified of you, Ms. Chairman, to add them before you started to go after their efforts.
I think both their efforts, Senator Pogomar, are likely to get nicked a little bit. Commissioner?
Page 20, Chairman. is putting a cap on Sustainable Forest Incentive Act payments. This is a program that gives a benefit to property owners who keep their property forested. Putting the cap at $100,000, as we're proposing here, would only impact four of the largest property owners. Our understanding of the rationale for this program is that it was to incent small property tax owners to keep their property forested for logging purposes. And there's four big property tax owners that would actually be adversely impacted by this. But all the small property, everybody else in the program, which is over 1,000, there's over 1,000 people currently enrolled in the program. Only four would be impacted by this.
Commissioner, would the governor view this as a corporate tax increase?
Other weeks it's like he would not.
I wonder how those four very large companies would view it.
This has been a growth area discussion, as you know, Chairman. Currently it's $8.61 an acre, but it's gone up substantially over the last 4 or 5 years. Cap has never been contemplated before, but we thought it was reasonable to cap on it.
Who was the author of that?
Oh,
might have been.
Page 21, Chairman, is a reduction in the in an appropriation that flows to the IRR. And this is an appropriation I believe was put into place back in 2001, and it's measured as as 22 cents, the equivalent, general fund appropriation equivalent to 22 cents of the production tax. We are recommending that be reduced to 7 cents, which is, I think we've spent about $8.5 million currently a year on this, and so we reduce that to about $3 million a year. And our intention is to make sure we hold the local units of government harmless. This is metered out. It's supposed to be metered out by statute in the same way the production tax is. And so our intention here at 7 cents is to hold the city, the counties, and the other local jurisdictions that receive some of this money harmless from that. And the agency itself is the one that will experience the reduction in this appropriation.
Commissioner, I remember when this was done in the 2001 tax bill, and what happened was when we were taking the school levy off of property, the mining companies, because they didn't pay property taxes, were essentially given this money. It was added to a program called the Investment Tax Credit Program, where the mining companies can get, I think it's a little over 30 cents a ton back. And the work at the time agreed to by Representative Sviggum, then Tax Chair Abrams, along with the Senate and the governor, was as long as the mining companies weren't going to get any property tax relief, that the state would give them some additional money to invest in their facilities because they didn't pay property taxes. So the way the Iron Range Resources tracks this money is this $5 million a year comes into the agency and flows through to the mining companies through the investment tax credit program. So, Commissioner, this is a cut in the rebate to the mining companies. Would the governor view that as a corporate tax increase?
Chairman, I know the custom and usage is to dedicate this money to the TEDF program, but there's nothing in the statute that contemplates that. It's not statutorily obligated to go to that program. It basically just says it's 22 cents, an appropriation equivalent to 22 cents production tax to be distributed in the same manner as the production tax is. So I know that's the way that the agency and the board has been utilizing this revenue. I've talked to Commissioner Lehman, and she thinks there's some other options in order to backfill the incentive program for the mines.
Because the way we currently do the budgeting, Commissioner, just so we're clear, this money is being taken away from the mining companies because the money flows into the agency, it goes to the TEDF fund, and the mining companies will lose a tax credit of $5.5 million a year. Under the way the state agency does the accounting, receives the money, just so that we're all clear, including the companies, that the way we currently account for the money, it amounts to a reduction in their tax credit.
We understand that, and we're hopeful that there's alternatives in order to hold that program harmless. On the next page, Chairman, is the federal conformity bill that the governor is recommending.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry.
Commissioner, you missed page 22.
Oh, PILT payments. I'm sorry, Chairman. This would be a 20% reduction in the PILT payments that are currently paid, and we're mainly just a conduit. The Department of Natural Resources sends us the PIL payment schedule, and we appropriate. But this would be a 20% reduction in the PIL payments that go up.
Commissioner, do you think there's any property tax impact in this?
Chairman, I'd expect there is.
Property tax increase as a result of the governor's proposal.
We looked at this the same way, Chairman, as we looked at LGA and the county program aid. We had a whole laundry list of all the aids and credits that go out, and this was not an easy decision, obviously, but we thought a 20% reduction was reasonable considering some of the other cuts that we were making.
Commissioner, one of the reasons that counties are willing to hold tax forfeited land, and it's within their authority to sell it, one of the reasons they hold it is the state makes up for some of the lost tax capacity through the payment in lieu of taxes program. St. Louis County, where I live, for example, has 900,000 acres of county tax forfeited land, most of which they could sell, and the county's tax base would be increased exponentially by them doing that. But the state provides some kind of a payment in lieu to encourage public land, and we all benefit from having that land open to the public for hunting and recreation and trails. And I think this is short-sighted, because if the counties decide to help fill their budget gap that's going to result from this and the loss of their county program aid, if they decide to start selling off some of those public parcels, which they're perfectly within their authority to do, I think we all lose.
Page 21, Chairman, is, as I got ahead of myself, this is the federal conformity that the governor is recommending that we adopt. It includes the vast majority of provisions to simplify the tax code, make sure we're in line and aligned with the federal code. There are a few exceptions to that, and the big ones are ones you are, I think many of you are familiar with. We're not conforming to tuition deduction, not conforming this proposal to the education expense deduction. Those are the two most costly ones. And it wasn't a policy decision so much, it was just a revenue decision. And those are expensive provisions, and we are opting not to conform to those two provisions. There's a couple others too, but those are the two material provisions I think most of the people on the committee are familiar with. I know that the House is moving the federal conformity bill quickly. That it's basically this bill. The only material difference is they do have the education expense provision, which is about $1 million a year, and their payment mechanism for absorbing the FY09 costs is a delay in the corporate refunds going out. So they're instructing the Department of Revenue to hold back the corporate refunds in order to pay for the conformity costs that are associated with fiscal 2009.
Interesting.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioner, are you looking at the income tax impacts of the federal stimulus bill? I mean, that's not, quote, a tax bill, but there's got to be some bumps in income there that the federal government can say they're not to be taxable. But if they come out in reduced withholding, wouldn't if we were wanted to conform, have to score that federal bill with regard to revenues?
Chairman, Senator Rest, you're right. And I know Dr. Wilson has taken a look at what the two vehicles are in both the House and Senate, what they're doing on the tax front. So far, we've been relieved that most of the actions they take would not have a detrimental impact on the state.
Because they're doing it on
been very
credits
this
rather than
right.
adjustments to income.
Right. So we
Let's
were,
hope they continue that.
Yeah. We're hopeful. We're relieved that the things that are on the table, at least right now, would not have a real material impact on our revenue situation. We could pick and choose which ones we wanted to conform to without a negative consequence. So stay tuned. Keep your fingers crossed. But right now, with the way that it's situated, we think it won't be a bad scenario for us. And the final two pages, Chairman, 25 and 26, are well, first of all, the education aid payment. You know, this is one of the components of the budget to shift the education recognition payment. This is the property tax implications of this. There are property tax implications for doing this as far as PTR and other programs that go out. So it's about $6.8 million. And then it's actually a little revenue increase in the out years. And then the last page is the PTR and income tax interactions for all the recommendations in the governor's budget. And that's that's a recognition of the property tax implications that will occur if we cut LGA county program aid. There will be more PTRs going out, and this is a recognition of those costs.
So, Commissioner, if you're able to calculate that, are you able to, do you have a number for, under the governor's budget, how many dollars you expect property taxes to go up statewide?
Chairman, we do have a preliminary number. You know, it's based on nonpartisan staff working together based on assumptions. You know, two-thirds of LGA will be levied back. If they're up against the levy limit, it's a different calculation. But based on their research, Eric Willett and others, $300 million in pay 2010 and $250 million in the following year is the calculation.
So,
and that's what this number is premised on, the PTR impact attributable to those property tax increases.
So over the biennium, Commissioner, a little bit over $500 million of additional property taxes would be paid under the governor's budget proposal.
That's a forecast about what the implications would be based on past methodology that we've done.
That's helpful. Thank you for having that. Any other questions of the Commissioner? Commissioner, if you could talk to your staff about putting a property tax overview proposal together for us and how changing market values are going to impact property taxes, I think we could probably all benefit from that.
Certainly, okay. Chairman. We'll be in touch with your staff to schedule that.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Langseth.
I'd like to ask kind of a general statement. In November, we came in $31 million below normal, below the forecast. In December, it was $100 million below. In January, it was $2 million below. That sounds like awful good news. Was there a quirk there, or was it good news?
Well, I took it as good news because I thought it'd be substantially worse than that. Yeah. Absolutely did. December revenues were 130 below, I believe it was. And corporate, the bottom fell out of corporate, as you know. Yesterday's news was good. I think it was $1.5 million below forecast in aggregate. Sales tax was above forecast. So I don't know if any one month. You know, there's always a caveat at the bottom of those. This is a snapshot in time. But it was good news from my perspective, and we'll have to stay tuned and see what happens next month.
Commissioner, have you been able to find an author for the governor's bill yet?
We have a couple that are actually interested in signing on, believe it or not. Yes, sir.
Senator Pogomel.
Well, when you have an author, let us know, and we'll be happy to have him in front of the committee.
Absolutely, Chairman.
Commissioner, thank you. Good luck over at the House today.
Thank you, Chairman.
Very good job. Senator Pogomel.
Chairman, members, Senate File 490 is a proposal that is similar to one that was here for a different facility, I believe in the 2002 session. Catholic Elder Care is a organization that provides housing services and nursing home services to low-income seniors in my community, Northeast Minneapolis. It owns a skilled nursing home, two assisted living facilities, two independent living facilities, and serves about 400 seniors, half of whom are in subsidized care. As I mentioned, in 2002, we gave a property tax exemption to allow them to build a facility in the neighborhood. Their campus is distributed a little. It's not all in one place. At St. Hedwig's Church, where 35 units of assisted living and 71 units of independent living services were constructed. That property tax exemption made the project work, and it is very active, and it's doing a fabulous job. The Catholic Elder Care now has a parcel of property across from its main campus, which is its nursing home, and they would like to construct an additional 66 additional units of affordable senior housing. This is a community that is obviously the demographics are changing dramatically, and there's just a lot more seniors, and they're trying to find ways to allow these families to keep their parents in the neighborhood. And that's the mission of Catholic Elder Care. And it basically serves Northeast Minneapolis, North Minneapolis, and the suburban areas on the northern tier, Columbia Heights, Fridley, Robbinsdale. That's where the families have migrated too often. So, so this bill is an attempt to also give a property tax exemption for this new proposed facility. It helps close the gap of financing. They still have to raise privately charity care dollars of about $1 million to make it all work. And but this is a vital piece to the proposed project. I have an amendment, Mr. Chairman, A1, that I'd like to put on the bill to get it in a technical form that makes it work.
Yeah, these, I think they're just looking
and
at the state
cost.
Yes.
So I'd like to offer the A1. The A1 I'd like to offer puts it in the technical
Senator Pogmeyer offers the A1.
And it just takes out a piece of criteria that's not necessary so that it actually does conform to the St. Hedwig's bill that we passed a couple years ago. And then also clarifies what kind of licensing or conditions under which the local government has adopted the design criteria for the project before this kicks in. It just clarifies that language.
Senator Pogamoto, does it do anything to take out the sales tax exemption?
I was going to do that next.
Okay.
You can make that part of this motion if you'd like to take out Section 2.
Do you have an amendment to do that or just the...
Just verbally, we could take Section 2 out. So as part of the A1, I'd also incorporate in that to take out Section 2.
A different version.
Senator Pogamoto, I see the
In the title
we have the sales tax exemption, but I don't actually see it in the text.
Yeah, we're not sure what happened there. The copy I've got has it in.
That's
Senator
very
Council,
strange.
What do we have before us?
Mr. Chair, members, excuse me, I had seen the version of the bill that had both sections in it. This is a little bit of a mystery, but...
So it looks like we're working with the one that did not have it in.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Pogamoto, yes. The text of Senate File 490 that's before us with that caption 09-1634 in the upper right-hand corner is just the property tax exemption.
Does the A1 fit still then?
Mr. Chairman, we would use just the provisions going through line... Line 6 of the amendment.
So I would move then the first 6 lines of the A1.
So Senator Pogamoto moves the A1 lines 1 through 6. And
this is just a bad copy.
Mr. Chairman?
We're missing
Mr. Chairman, I think it's because we're missing one page. We've got
missing
section
page
1 and 3.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the bill wasn't copied right.
Okay.
That's right, page 1 and 3.
Yeah. Details.
Well, the amendment is right.
Yes.
Is bill to begin?
Yeah.
Why don't we, while we're getting the copy, Mr. Chairman, why don't we just take the testimony on it. The bottom line is the bill would be just a property tax exemption, not the sales tax exemption. For Mr. Holmes, I have... people who run the facilities, if there's questions about the type of care and so forth, but it's by and large an attempt to provide affordable senior care and living in multiple environments, both assisted and actual nursing. And this is just an addition to their efforts to make it bigger because they... the market is much bigger in the neighborhoods for this. So.
Senator Pogamoto, do we have any idea how the city or the county feel?
They're supportive. So why don't I defer to Mr. Holmes and
on the technical parts of the financing, if you want, and why this doesn't totally close the gap, but it does partially close the gap, which allows them to make it work.
From a cash flow standpoint.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Jim Holmes. I represent Catholic Elder Care. I was involved at the drafting of this bill and certainly can try to answer any technical questions you might have about the drafting itself. And that's why the amendments today, we tried to pattern it exactly after what you did in 2002 for St. Hedwig's and Catholic Elder Care. In terms of the cash flows, pro formas, and so on and so forth, Mike Chasky, who is the Chief Financial Officer of Catholic Elder Care, is here and certainly can give you any background or answer any questions you have about that.
Mr. Chairman, just don't know how deeply you want to go into it. I think with the amendments, it will be the same as the St. Hedwig's bill. And that did work, and the anticipation is it would work here again, even under current market conditions.
Mr. Chair.
Sir, let's go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for Ms. Soff. Now, if this is a nonprofit, and do they not meet that definition of charity care so they don't get the property tax exemption? Or does that have anything to fit with that court case that occurred last week?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, I think the treatment of charitable properties, first of all, it's been very confused over the years, but there are separate provisions that apply to what is essentially low-income housing, so that low-income housing has maybe a tougher standard to meet before it would be exempt than some other charitable properties. So without this kind of a provision, this facility would be taxable.
And, Mr. Chair, Ms. Soff, so this is considered a low-income housing facility?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Skoy, the bill does provide that there has to be, I don't have my copy of the bill with me now, but there is an income limit that would be, I think it's 30%, okay, thank you, 30% of the units have to be occupied by individuals whose income does not exceed 50% of the median family income. There was an alternative in here that's been taken out by the amendment.
Mr. Chairman,
thank
Senator
you.
Skoy, that you're right on. That's what this is all about. We're trying to thread the needle here, and this has to be a nonprofit. So we are setting up criteria that makes it clear that this type of facility will qualify. Not owned and operated by a nonprofit, located on a campus containing a church that is exempt from property taxation, provides affordable housing services. Services only those 62 or over or handicapped. And so, and there's income restrictions, which the Senate Council just mentioned. So that is the issue. This bill, as it did in the St. Hedwig circumstance, draws specific criteria to basically make sure that this facility does get property tax.
Thank you.
By limiting it so that you don't get into the larger issues that we've dealt with over the years.
So, members, we now have the total text. So Senator Pogemiller moves the A1 lines 1 through 6 and deletes section 2.
Correct.
Any questions? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
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 Contrary, no. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Any other discussion on the bill?
Thank you.
Testifiers want to say anything further?
I'm Mary Broderick, the president and CEO, and our entire Catholic Elder Care community and the community we serve. Thanks you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the work that you do. You're providing a very valuable need in the community, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members? If not, Chair Leos over Senate File 490 as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
Senator Marty? Senator Marty?
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 396 is a very simple bill. It's got lots of changes in here, but the only one of substance, so in lines 16 and 17, the auditor does not have to direct the publisher to republish the entire list. But this is a bill that deals with counties are required to list delinquent property taxes, publish them in a newspaper, and if there's a mistake in the publishing under current law, they have to republish the entire list, which is actually less useful to people because then it's harder to find out where the mistakes were and it takes everybody's time. The counties are asking for us to change it so they only have to republish the correction, and the Newspaper Association is fine with this, and Keith Carlson is here from MICA to speak to the bill, fill in the gaps that I didn't fill in.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you, Keith Carlson with the Minnesota Intercounty Association. I want to indicate that both our organization as well as the Association of Minnesota Counties support this legislation. It's exactly as Senator Marty characterized. When a property becomes delinquent on its taxes, we send mailed notice to each one of the affected taxpayers. In addition, we have to publish a complete list of all the delinquent property taxes payers, the property identification number, the amount owed in legal newspapers twice. That's frankly quite costly because we're talking about dozens, if not hundreds, of properties. For example, Washington County, it costs them $4,000 just for one publication. If there happens to be an error in any one of those individual notices, it's required to be republished again two more times. And obviously that doubles the cost. For example, for Washington County, it would be an additional $8,000. So we are very supportive of this legislation and encourage the committee to pass the bill separately because it could save us costs for the current year. Publication occurs in March.
Mr. Carlson, is there did it just recently happen to somebody so that this all of a sudden came to our attention? Or,
Mr. Chairman, members, the committee might recall there was a piece of legislation passed in 2005 that allowed the counties, all local governments, to identify mandates that they thought were worthy of reform or repeal on the state auditor's website. This was one of those items that was listed. Unfortunately, you know, it was not picked up by the legislature until this time, and Senator Marty and I believe Representative Welty over in the House were kind enough to notice and finally pick up this provision. It's just been a long-standing issue. You know, generally we hope to avoid these mistakes, but when they do happen, you know, it is costly to publish the corrections, which again requires that the entire list, not just the correction for the individual property, be published.
Senator Scheid, I'm sorry.
Chairman, I wondered, I don't know if Senator Marty or Mr. Carlson said, what's a typical cost? I mean, I'm sure it's different for different counties, but just, I mean, typically, what is it?
Madam, Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, I can only give you the examples for two counties. Again, for Washington County, just one publication cost them $4,000. In Scott County, their cost was approximately $2,700. Obviously, it depends on the bids that they receive as well as the length of the list.
Then, Mr. Chairman. I just have a question about, I mean, do we let the county ever recoup that when taxes are paid? And is that
Mr. Chairman, Senator Scheid, the counties are allowed to charge the cost for administration of this to the affected properties, but unfortunately, some properties never pay. They ultimately are forfeit, so we can't recover from them, or in some instances the cities or other jurisdictions give us notice after they forfeited that they would like to use them for a governmental purpose, so we never recover our entire costs.
But Mr. Chairman, I was just concerned they can recover some if it sells. And okay, thank you.
Senator Marty, do we know what the House is doing with this?
Mr. Chairman, I do not know if their planning is a separate bill or not.
Well, Senator Marty, why don't we hang on to it? We'll try to have a discussion with the House Tax Chair and see if she's going to move it out and if if they want to do that, I guess I don't see a reason we couldn't concur, but there's not much point of us doing it if they're not going to, I guess. So,
we will check with them, and you can check as well, but we'll get back to you.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions, members? Chair lays over Senate File 396.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Chair.
Members, I think Senator Rest asked the question last time we met about corporate taxpayers by payroll, what percentage their tax liabilities were, and we have revenue. Dr. Wilson over at Revenue supplied us with a little one-sheet handout. Take a look at it. It's in your...
in here?
On your desk. Anything else, members? We'll make Senator Rest aware of that, too, so in the event you didn't see it. But. Members, we're going to meet Wednesday next week, and then next week also on Friday we're going to have the Tax Committee up in Moorhead. So we will adjourn until Wednesday next week. Oh.
Enough members?
We think about seven members.
Are you driving?